that really focuses in on national security and strategic studies, also international relations and intelligence. We offer doctorates programs and graduate programs, and we have 18 certificates as well. And if you're interested in any of our programs, please let us know, and you can find out more information at www.iwp.edu. We'd also like to thank our supporters this afternoon for most of our IWP program events, especially Mr. Cedric Welsh Muhammad and Mrs. Mara Svezjek, to support and have supported our work over the years, and we're very grateful. Today's lecture is part of the student speaker series. We will be hearing from Mr. Carlos Altore, who will discuss a lecture entitled China's Space Operations, Assessing PLA Capabilities for U.S. Strategy. Carlos is one of our outstanding MA candidates for statecraft and national security fairs at IWP with a specialization in defense. Prior to joining IWP, he was a middle school teacher who spent 5 years, I had no idea, 5 years in English in South Korea and China before deciding to make the transition over to national security and the intelligence field. He brings his experience of Chinese political culture and East Asian geography, as well as his Mandarin skills, to complement his studies in Chinese military and geopolitical affairs in the Indo-Pacific. His research focuses in on China's usage of emerging technologies, specifically the PLA's research in implementation of AI, space, cislunar operations, and hypersonic missiles. In the deep end of the pool, for sure, no question. Originally from Southern California, he earned his BA in philosophy from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And on a personal note, Carlos has been one of the outstanding colleagues. Typically, he's the one organizing these events, getting out all of the details for all of us. So it really is an honor to hear him now speak from his area of expertise, which both you and I are going to be the beneficiaries of here this afternoon. So would you please welcome Carlos as he comes now to address us.
So thank you for everyone for coming. It's really nice of you to be here. I, like Captain Glass said, I'm a student here at IWP. This is my last semester. This presentation is based off of a strategy paper that I wrote in a class called Emerging Threats. It's with Professor Sugrones. It's a great class. Highly recommend it. But in that class, the point of it was to look at the threats and risks of some issue in the hopes of building a strategy. And the way we do that is we ask the question, well, what are the plans, intentions, and capabilities of that threat in question? And in this case, we're talking about China's space operations, what the PLA is planning and what they're doing up in space. So this is what we're going to be looking at. The first thing is, what's going on up there? So I'm just going to give a quick snapshot of what's happening in terms of satellites and everything. But something I do want to answer is, what are the U.S. interests in space when we talk about U.S. interests? Well, basically, there are satellites, our space assets. Okay, satellites are important because, well, what's really important in space is the information that passes back and forth between the satellites and the ground, and also the functionality of these satellites. We have many different types in many different orbits, some for reconnaissance and surveillance, some for GPS. So this is a quick rundown of the types of satellites we have. The other interest is access to space. And this is something that has popped up in the last few years of, why do we need access to space? Why do we need a presence in space? Well, there's two main reasons. it's defense and economics. And the obvious one that goes without saying is scientific discovery. I think that's the most important thing, but I'm gonna lump that into economics for the purposes of this this talk. So let's move on. So here's satellite numbers, and if you're unfamiliar with the orbits, there's a picture on the side. I want to really focus on LEO, which is low Earth orbit, and GEO, which is geosynchronous orbit, because I think those are the most popular right now. But LEO is the one closest to Earth in that picture, and GEO stands for geosynchronous. It's when you have a satellite that is about 35,000 kilometers from Earth, and it's rotating with the Earth. So it's always looking at the same location. Very good for communication satellites. So as of May 2023, and this most likely will need to be updated because a lot of launches have happened since then, but there's over 7,500 active satellites in orbit. You can see the US has a very high number of those satellites. And China, there's a wide margin between the US and China, but China is trying to catch up. You can see that in LEO, low Earth orbit, that's where it's very crowded. Over 6,500 satellites. And GEO is going to get crowded in the next few years. So now let's look at China's satellite numbers. And these pictures on the side show just an idea of how crowded low Earth orbit is right now. And then you have GEO down at the bottom. So China has about 507 satellites in LEO. Some of the prominent ones are Earth observation satellites. And that's important because something we're going to talk about later is military-civil fusion. I'll touch on that. But the idea of dual-use technology, that China, the PLA, has control over all of China's space operations, including the commercial side. So if you have commercial satellites being used for Earth observation, more than likely the PLA is going to use that for a military capability. And then you have some in GEO. And an example of this is the Beidou series of satellites. That's China's GPS, basically their equivalent of the GPS. PNT refers to position, navigation, and timing. And that's GPS, or on the military side, use that for precision guided munitions. So something I want to highlight about the Beidou series is that a lot of the BRI countries are strongly encouraged to get onto the Beidou system. And on top of that, I think about 30 countries so far are signed on. And that's about 400 million users on the Chinese GPS equivalent. So now I want to move on to the plans and intentions portion of this. What is the CCP and Xi Jinping, what are they planning? What are their political objectives with space? So when I was looking at all the defense white papers going back to 2010, I noticed that there was a very different tone that happens. There's a change in tone as you look at them. In 2010, there were very few references to outer space, but all the references that were for outer space all dealt with cooperation, peaceful use, a lot of references to the Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space with the UN. So there was also this concern of weaponization in space. And that makes sense because around this time, the PLA was studying all of the U.S. military successes in the Gulf War. So the Gulf War was the first time the U.S. used satellites to support terrestrial ground forces. And you were using precision strikes and stealth and joint operational capabilities. So the PLA saw this and they were like, oh, wow, like this is an awakening. We need to modernize. This is a concern. So then 2013, you have Xi Jinping who becomes president. And that's when you start to see the tone really change. Very few references to space, but a lot of references towards informationization. What is informationization? It's basically the idea that the PLA wants to win local wars by dominating the information space. And this could be across all domains, including outer space. This is very much in line with their three warfares strategy, the idea of winning without fighting, kind of manipulating the opponent through public opinion, through lawfare, through psychological operations. So this kind of falls in line with that. And then we get to 2015. We have more references to outer space and a lot of references towards strategic competition. So now the weaponization of space is becoming a national security concern to China and the PLA. And I want to highlight this quote. The first signs of weaponization of outer space have appeared. China will deal with security threats and challenges in that domain, secure its space assets, and maintain outer space security. So now we get to 2019. The outer space references just keep ticking up. You have that China is trying to match U.S. expenditures. Of course, they're not doing that right now, but they're trying. And the interest is in safeguarding China's new critical domain, which is outer space. And I'll have this quote, outer space is a critical domain in international strategic competition. Its security provides strategic assurance for national and social development. And then we get to 2022 and we have an entire defense white paper dedicated solely to outer space. So at the 20th Communist Party Congress, Xi Jinping states to explore the vast cosmos, develop the space industry, and build China into a space power is our eternal dream. And I won't read this whole quote, but I want to highlight these parts of protecting China's interests, strengthening its space presence, and governance of outer space. This is a big one because the idea is whoever gets to space first and takes control of certain areas in the cislunar region, they're going to set the standards, the norms of behavior for future space development. So this is just I wanted to show a picture of where all the ground stations and launch centers are in China. But just to highlight the launch centers, there are these four locations. That for a while, the newest one was in Wenchang, which is in Hainan province, down at the bottom there. And the reason is because you want a center closer to the equator, as close as possible. The closer you get to the equator, the less energy you're going to need to launch something, especially a heavy lift rocket, into orbit. But there was another platform that was made, and it was outside Haiyang Port. And this platform was actually a floating barge that was capable of launching heavy lift rockets. And with this barge, you can take this all the way down to the South China Sea if you wanted and perform a launch out there. So it's just enhanced capability, and it's actually pretty impressive. So here's a list of China's ambitions in space, going from, at least from my opinion, most important in their minds, be a complete space power by 2045, right? That makes sense. The 100th anniversary is 2049, 100th anniversary, sorry, of the founding of the People's Republic of China. So this is really seen as a great power status. Deny access and degrade adversarial assets. Why do we want to deny access? Well, when the PLA was studying American successes with the Gulf War and just how impressive the American military was in using satellites to assist their ground forces, the PLA was like, well, we're not going to catch that. The U.S. is really impressive. So how do you gain parity with the U.S. with such an impressive force? Well, you take away their ability to conduct operations with support from space. And how do you do that? Well, you either deny access to that force or you make counter space weapons and you destroy them. So the next one is establish a permanent presence. They've done this, the Tiangong space station, which was completed and realized in 2022. So that's already in orbit. And that's going to be in orbit even after the International Space Station deorbits within the next 10 or so years. The next one, establish end-to-end supply chain infrastructure. This is a really interesting and important one, I think, if you have long-term ambitions to put architecture in space. You want to have fewer launches, and you want to have larger platforms in space so that you can conduct more operations going forward. Control strategic points in the cislunar region. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. And energy security and resource extraction. This is something that I think a lot of countries have an interest in, but China specifically really has an interest in. So let's move on to the actual threats. So I group these threats into three categories. In-orbit threats, cislunar, so that's everything from the Earth to the Moon, and beyond. And beyond is just my short, cute word for the future space economy, just resource extraction with Moon, Mars, asteroids, and all that. So here are the counter space weapon types. And when I talk about counter space weapon, you're going to hear me say the word ASAT. That just means anti-satellite weapons, so ASATs. I'm not talking about orbital bombardment. That's not going to be discussed in this. We're just talking about attacks on the satellites in the sky. So these are the four types. We're going to look at the first one, which is kinetic physical. So this involves any type of ASAT weapon where you have kinetic contact with that satellite, which aims to either destroy it or damage it permanently. And so the most popular one is the direct ascent ASAT. This is one I think a lot of people know about. In 2007, China launched a ballistic missile to one of their defunct satellites and blew it up. And it created like 3,000 pieces of debris that's still orbiting to this day. Next, you have co-orbital. And this is a really interesting one because China actually conducted a test with their, I believe it was the Fengyuan satellite. It was the Shijian 21 satellite. It had a grappling arm, and they used it to grab onto the Compass G2, which was a malfunctioning Beidou satellite. And with that grappling arm, they dragged that other satellite into graveyard orbit, which is beyond GEO, right? And they just let it go. And so this seems like a benign capability, but we talked about dual-use technology. We talked about military civil fusion, where the PLA can utilize commercial capabilities for military capabilities. This could easily be used on any satellite. And then the last one is ground station attack. And this isn't something that's like technically happened, but it's something that China has the capability to do. You attack the ground station and it affects the data and the signals to those satellites. I want to touch on RPOs and space planes because this has a lot to do with co-orbital ASATs. What are RPOs? That stands for rendezvous and proximity operations. So when you have two objects in the sky, when you have two satellites and they're in different orbits, your satellite needs to have the ability to maneuver close to another satellite in order to do some really impressive things. And why would you need to maneuver it close to another satellite? Well, two reasons. You either want to fix it or you want to follow it. And fixing a satellite, that's just my short word for removing space debris from orbit, on-orbit servicing and refueling, getting close to another satellite to repair it or to be refueled. But why would you want to follow a satellite? Well, you follow it to attack it, or you follow it to possibly steal information, or maybe take pictures of structural weaknesses. So this really highlights the idea of cooperative versus non-cooperative RPOs in space. And an example of a cooperative RPO is that Pakistan has a satellite called the PakSat-1, and it's in geosynchronous orbit. It's co-located with a French-Italian satellite called Athena Fidus. Those two pass by each other all the time, but those governments have an agreement. They have communication saying, hey, we're getting close to each other. This isn't a hostile action. And that would be cooperative RPO. What we don't want is non-cooperative RPOs, and it's really difficult to track those. Something I want to also talk about with RPOs is space planes. Now, what is a space plane? This is the US space plane, the X-37B. This was in orbit, I think, for over 900 days. For a long time, we didn't know that China had a space plane. But on August 4th, 2022, a space plane or an object was launched from one of China's launch centers. And it turned out to be, the thinking was that it was a space plane. And there are a lot of reasons for that. There was a lot of investigation to figure that out. But it wasn't just that that space plane looked exactly, almost exactly like ours. That space plane in orbit released an object. And that object was conducting RPOs. It was maneuvering around China's space plane, which is codenamed Shenlong. So I'll call it Shenlong. So it was moving around Shenlong and doing all kinds of RPOs. And this is an issue because we don't know what that object was doing, what the purpose of it. The state media in China, of course, kept this whole thing secret. They announced the operation after it landed, but we don't know what it was doing. And that object, for all we know, is still up there, and it has propulsive capability based on the fact that it was conducting RPOs with space plane. So I wrote an article about this, just kind of talking about the likelihood that these objects and the space plane is basically the future infrastructure for a co-orbital ASAT potential. So now let's get into the next type, non-kinetic physical. This essentially means directed energy weapons, lasers, high-powered microwaves, and of course, EMP and the nuclear explosion. China has all of these capabilities. Just keep in mind, EMP and nuclear explosion, that's something that would cause a lot of damage. This is a picture of the aftermath of Operation Starfish Prime, when the U.S. detonated a nuclear weapon in the upper atmosphere. There was a lot of damage, and this isn't the thing that I would worry about China doing first. This is electronic warfare, and they're pretty proficient at doing this, at uplink and downlink jamming, and at spoofing. And so just an explanation of what uplink and downlink jamming is, basically you're trying to affect or disrupt the RF signals that are going from, you know, a dish to some type of transmitter. And so uplink, you try to affect the satellite. I think it's the harder one to do, but it has the better payoff, because if you affect the satellite, then that message is going to go out to all its recipients, interrupted or garbled. The downlink one, I think, is a little easier, but it's localized to whoever the recipient is or whatever the recipient is. Then you have spoofing, and there was an incident not long ago where about 300 ships in the Huangpu River were affected by what was deemed spoofing attack. And that's where you deceive the receiver. You trick them into thinking that the signal they're getting is a different type of signal, and it can change GPS positions. And that's what happened with those ships. Their GPS positions were bouncing around every couple of minutes. And then, of course, we have cyber attacks. This is also one I think we should be most worried about China doing. Cyber attacks target the data, not the RF signals. And this is dangerous because you could easily insert corrupt data into a satellite and basically affect its orbit. You can cause it to burn up in the atmosphere. So now we're going to move on to cislunar threats. So what is cislunar? It's, like I said, it was everything between the Earth and the Moon, and that includes the orbits around the Earth, the orbits around the Moon, and all of these points. And if you're not familiar, these are Lagrange points. And they're very, very interesting, because all of this is being considered important for strategic positioning. What is a Lagrange point? Well, if the big orb is the Earth and the small one is the Moon, you have 5 points between them where you have the ability to get a stable position, because the gravity between those two are pulling equally. So in those spots, you can put a satellite, and I'm really oversimplifying this, but you can put a satellite and it'll essentially float there. It'll be stable in some of these points. these are being seen as strategic positions. So much so that, well, just to backtrack, we have the James Webb Telescope in a Lagrange point, 1 million miles from Earth, and it stays there stable because of the equilibrium of the gravity, and it's taking beautiful pictures of the universe and sending it back to us. So no military satellite was ever placed in a Lagrange point until China's Treqiao relay satellite. And they did this because when they launched the Chang'e 4 in 2019 to land on the dark side of the moon, the far side of the moon, I should say, they needed a way to communicate with it. So how do you do that when you can't see the dark side of the moon because you're always looking at one side of the moon? Well, you put a comm relay satellite in a Lagrange point and it'll be stable and you can bounce messages between the satellite and the lander. Why is this a concern? Well, China and Russia are planning on building the International Lunar Research Station. And this construction is planned for 2036. If you have a comm relay satellite in the Lagrange point, you have an easy way to communicate with that station on the far side of the moon. So this is a concern. The last threat section beyond really has to do with the future space economy. This picture up here is a picture of the south pole of the moon and all of the potential water deposits of the moon, frozen water. It's no surprise that China and Russia are trying to develop this International Lunar Research Station near the South Pole. And the concern is that without some type of governing framework, you can have this station in the South Pole and a country like China, who is already setting up the 10-dash line around the South China Sea and claiming this territory as, oh, we navigated it first, so this is ours. The concern is that they would do the same thing in this region. We don't have any type of framework to say, well, who owns territory, who owns resources in this area. So this is something that's kind of interesting to look at. This picture right here is supposed helium-3 deposits on the moon. Helium-3 is this proposed energy source that would be used through nuclear fusion. And it links with the top right picture. So when the Chang'e 5 lunar sample return mission got back to Earth, it had a material that the Chinese called Chang'e Site Y. And this mineral was lauded as this big scientific achievement because China said, well, now we can learn more about the history of the moon. But actually, the China Atomic Energy Authority was also very interested in this because supposedly it was covered in helium-3. And so this was deemed as a new material, a new mineral, and potentially new energy source. And it's just no coincidence that this is something that China is really pursuing. The last picture is space-based solar power. So this is also something that a lot of Chinese researchers are really actively pursuing. They're trying to make this a reality. They have goals to have space-based solar power platform in geosynchronous orbit by 2035, 100 megawatt one. And by 2050, they'd like to be able to supply all of China with energy from this solar power platform in geo. So now I'll just talk about the risks. And these are the risks that I identified as I was doing the strategy paper. Something that kept coming up was the fact that the US and its allies really rely on space militarily and economically much more than China does. There are also, with the counter-space weapons research, there's no real adequate defenses for the satellites we currently have in orbit. So this is important to understand. Like with non-cooperative RPOs, it's really difficult to identify them from the ground, especially if you're talking about geosynchronous orbit. It's just very difficult to see from the ground. Also, in the event of some type of conflict, like in the South China Sea, it's worth it to the PLA to strike first, to deny the U.S. Entrance into that conflict. And the reason for that is because the U.S. has the advantage. So this was one risk that I looked at. I know it has a lot of information in it. The second risk I saw that I just kept popping up was that there really is no adequate framework. And the only thing we have right now is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. That was mainly focused on nuclear weapons, preventing nuclear weapons from being in orbit or detonated in orbit. It also doesn't really define properly what a weapon is. It just says no conventional weapons. But, you know, as you've seen, grappling arms and all of these other capabilities are being used in the dual use capacity as potential weapons. So that's a serious issue. The next thing is that there's no verification or compliance mechanisms. How do we check these things? How do we check the satellites if they are indeed a weapon? We're not going to show off some of our satellites for good reasons. I mean, we have proprietary information in there. Another thing is there's no regulations or recognized law for territorial rights or resource extraction. This is something that really needs to be worked on. So now I'll end it with the strategies that I looked at while I was working on this paper. And some of the short-term strategies were basically disaggregation and distribution of satellites, using multiple satellites for the same function, so that if you shoot one down or something happens to it, you have others to back it up. Or having multiple satellites all doing the same job with the same capacity. There's a problem with this, though. If we're looking at potentially having 16,000 satellites in orbit, this having additional constellations for defensive purposes could be an issue. There's also the idea of shielding, filtering, adding shutters or filters to the optical sensors of satellites to prevent them from being dazzled with lasers or, you know, affected by other types of non-kinetic physical weapons. Another thing that I thought was important was to employ more private firms to do space situational awareness. It's very difficult to see what's going on in space. That space plane, that was being tracked by both the Space Force and Leo Labs, a private company that tracks things in space. But still, we didn't have as much information as we would have liked. So employing more firms to share that burden, I think, is very important for space situational awareness, especially with the issue of non-cooperative RPOs. There is no clean way to handle that situation, whether you put defensive satellites or some type of ADIS, you know, identification zone or something, all of that has problems. So this is an issue. That's why we need a lot more space situational awareness. And another idea was to get AI involved in space domain awareness into the DoD. I think the benefits of AI in this regard would be extremely helpful. And some of the long-term strategies, investment in commercial space launch vehicles, which we're kind of already doing. I mean, you see in this graph, back with the space shuttle, it was about $51,000 per kilo to launch into orbit. With Starship, you're looking at the estimate being like $200 per kilo. So the lower the cost, the more that we can put into space, and eventually over time, the fewer launches we need. Let's see, what else do we have? U.S. should lead an effort to update the Outer Space Treaty, or at least some type of regulatory framework. Right now, the Outer Space Treaty is just not adequate enough. And China and Russia actually tried proposing a new type of treaty, and the U.S. wasn't having it. But I really believe that the U.S. should call out irresponsible behavior, and a democratic country like the U.S. has to be the one to set the standards and the norms in space. You don't want countries like Russia and China, governments like those, establishing that behavior. And that's what this whole Artemis Accords and the Lunar Research Station, they're basically both competing blocks. And the Artemis Accords represents about, I believe, 36 signatories. And that's the one that really should be promoted. And the last one I put is establishing the foundational infrastructure. I really, really believe that the U.S. should invest and put more effort into establishing these energy projects in space and setting up the end-to-end supply chain infrastructure in space if they want to have a lasting impact. So that's the end of my presentation. Really appreciate you all coming out and listening. And if you have any questions or concerns or comments or feedback, directions to go with this research, really appreciate it. Thank you. I was completely unaware of the Antarctica's treaty. Thank you for suggesting that. Okay, yeah. Actually, yes, that's a very good question. I forgot to actually put that in here, but the idea was not just promote or invest in commercial firms for space launch vehicles, but kind of encourage this, I don't know if loyalty is the right word, but companies that really want to promote U.S. interests. I don't know how we would solve this Elon Musk issue, the potential issue. I know he has his gigafactory in China. But yeah, that's cars. Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's one for consideration. I would really want to promote the companies that are looking out for US interests. I think that's an important point. Hi. All of the research I didn't see anything regarding fractional orbital bombardment system or any type of, what are the old ones, rods from God, anything like that. I didn't see anything of that sort. I know there's been a lot of stuff in the news about Russia and nukes, but really in all the research I looked, these were the biggest concerns. New warfighting domain where it's basically satellite on satellite or ground forces aiming at satellites. That was the issue. Not, I didn't see anything regarding bombardment towards the surface. Sure. The FOBS is the fractional orbital bombardment system. And back during the Cold War, the Soviet Union was looking into this capability to essentially send something into space and have it do not a complete orbit. It would go the other direction. So if you wanted to bomb something in the north, you would go south and it would completely orbit the globe and target something in the, in the northern part. And the idea was that it wouldn't be a complete orbital weapon because it wasn't making a complete orbit. And so this was something the Soviet Union was looking into, but, I don't believe they were very successful with it. And so, unfortunately, I didn't cover a lot of information in potential FOBs armaments or capabilities recently. This was all of the counter space weapons in orbit or going to orbit were the predominant things I looked at. But that's my knowledge of FOBs.
So much, Carlos, for your presentation. I'm an alumni of IWP. I'd like to know, regarding your background research on this topic, were there any, speaking about Soviets and concerns, were there any kind of inklings of of China and the CCP, Xi Jinping, learning from U.S. experience with outer space deterrence through things like SDI, for example? Or do you believe that it's just merely trying to have parity, not necessarily dominance, regarding any potential innovation that the United States doesn't have? Any inklings towards lessons learned by China from SDI?
Yeah, thank you, Philip. That's a great question. There was a quote by Brian Whedon basically talking about how much of what China is doing is echoing what we've been talking, what the U.S. has been talking about for a long time, and how much of it is their own ambitions, their own strategy, and it's really tough to say because a lot of what the state media says is, well, we're doing this to protect ourselves because the U.S. is scaring us; they're a big bully and they're a threat. That's been their driving force. But I mean, if you look at somebody like Michael Pillsbury, who talks about the 100-year marathon. You see that China is trying to gain control of any domain that's going to give it, give the country an advantage. So my opinion is that the idea that, oh, we're trying to protect ourselves and what the U.S. is doing is it could potentially affect our national security, I believe that's just posturing because the aim was get an advantage any way you can. And if the U.S. had this advantage, in a lot of the previous conflicts that they fought, it was just a kind of a wake-up call to the PLA to get on the ball so that we can be, if we can't be better than them, we need to win this war without fighting and take away their advantage. So that's essentially what I found.
That was a fascinating presentation. First, you get a lot in there in just a short time.
Yeah.
It's also very sobering. And other additional sources of operational energy as we're all moving into space. Well, you talked about the change site Y. Mm-hmm. Did you look at either requirements for and maybe even potential other energy sources?
Thank you for the question. I mentioned Chang'e Site Y as one example of what China was actively pursuing. Helium-3 was a big, there was a lot of literature on helium-3 in respect to China. Another big source of not necessarily energy, but I guess it would be energy because it ties into the whole energy transition happening now, where just a lot of the rare earth metals that are on the moon. So that was a big, I found a lot of information on that as well, that the moon is valuable. Asteroids are valuable because they have a lot of these rare earth metals that will assist in different sources of energy that we use. For example, right now with all the batteries that we're making. China already cornered, or at least is trying to corner the market with rare earth metals and critical elements. I believe, according to what I researched, they're trying to do the same thing. And they're trying to gain an advantage in energy in any way possible. And I think that's why they're exploring all of these options, like the helium-3, like the rare earth metals, like the space-based solar power, just to try to, get a huge advantage and cover their butts. So, thank you.
Max DiGiovanni from the NASA Center. You mentioned the U.S.'s intent to build systems of more resilient desire. Satellites. I've looked into some of the methods that we get the satellites into orbit in a more cheap manner, like low-light air launch systems, stuff like that. Have you looked into any of those means of reducing the cost of building redundancy?
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. I did not look different methods. All I really looked into were the launch vehicles and the size of the launch vehicles based on how much tonnage we can take into space from one launch vehicle. But that's really interesting. I mean, the space plane itself can be put into orbit vertically or horizontally. So it could piggyback off of a plane, or it could be strapped to a rocket. So that is a really interesting area to look into, and that's something I should definitely look into. But I didn't get any information on additional ways to get these launch vehicles in, or these spacecraft in space. So thank you for that.
Tim Hunter, you mentioned kind of trying to accommodate all spheres.
Yes, I am.
They're all over, right? No difference. This is incredible. Is it not possible to get a rough estimate of how much it costs for this call? And you have to break it down into productive uses of space, like resources, and then the other stuff, the military stuff.
You know what? Unfortunately, I do not. Thank you for that question. That is another blind spot. I don't have the actual budgetary amounts. There is a lot more money being poured into the Space Force and into Space Command. But as for the amount of money for all of these space launches, I don't have. What I do know, though, is that a lot of the commercial firms that are launching into space, they're doing it for cheaper and cheaper. They're doing it for lower amounts. And that's going to happen with the more launches we do and as the technology gets better. So as for the government allocating money, I don't have that data. But as for the cost of launches and the cost of putting infrastructure into space, I do know it's getting a lot cheaper. But actual numbers, actual data, I don't have those graphs in front of me, so I apologize for that.
Hi, Carlos. Dr. Please, my question is kind of reviews, but 2015 Nobel Prize was won for recognition that an astronomical phenomenon, and this was created by a Chinese announcement that Dr. Zingle's proton to the satellite. This obviously implies that you might have that.
Great. Thank you for that question. You know what? I did not come across anything regarding U.S. capability for any type of satellites that have some sort of quantum entanglement. I think it's within China's interest to announce any capability it has, any advantage. It could be used as a propaganda tactic. It could also be used to intimidate the U.S. I can understand why the U.S. wouldn't put those type of capabilities out into the public domain to be understood. But you know what? I don't have exact information on all of that. But it does make sense to me that China would try to announce every single scientific achievement or technological innovation that they have. It really is part of this great power status. And it's telling the world that China is ready to lead in a lot of these areas, whether it's space, energy, you name it. So I think that's very much in line. As for the veracity of that claim, I mean, I don't know. If there was a Nobel laureate, then it must have some truth to it. But as for US capabilities, I'm not sure. Any other questions, comments? All right, well, thank you. I really appreciate you coming. And,